Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find three separate speaker feeds with over 200 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Michael.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Michael, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Michael.
I ate a late lunch with my daughter, Isabella, who's here tonight, and I don't know about you guys, but probably the thing that I've been doing since I got here, well, not since, but what I've learned how to do is to take a fifth step with my food on a daily basis. And for those of you who are new, congratulations, by the way, to all the birthday people and the shift takers. I think that's really cool. Fifth step is admitted to God, yourself, and another human being the exact nature of your wrongs. Well, I substitute food for wrongs, so admit to myself and to God and another human being the exact nature of my food on a daily basis, to be honest about what I eat. And so I wasn't quite sure where I was going to eat for lunch, so I told my sponsor I would text him, you know. But for those of you who use that tool, it's really hard to text after you take that first bite. Because, you know, I've already ordered, I know what I'm going to eat, well, I'll text in a minute. And the food was almost gone, and, you know, and I finally texted him at the end of the thing. But I'm kind of a perfectionist when it comes to food, and I'm compulsive about it, just like you guys. And I came to you guys in the early 80s, I guess. I got sober originally in 1982, and I celebrated a year of sobriety, I guess, in 83, and I had a three-pack-a-day cigarette addiction, and I couldn't stop. So in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started bitching and complaining about my cigarette addiction, and old-timers told me to shut up. And they told me, you know, the tradition, you just need to stop drinking. We don't want to hear about your cigarettes. And I got offended. And I thought you could share anything at an AA meeting. And somebody took me aside and said, Michael, you know, there's a Smokers Anonymous. Why don't you go and identify there? I think it's still around. I think they call it Nicotine Anonymous now. And so I went. And I bitched and complained a little bit, and there was like one person there, and the guy told me what he was like, what happened, and what he's like today, and he said, I'll see you next week. And I came back, and it took about 6 weeks, if I recall, and the three-pack-a-day addiction was lifted after about 6 weeks. And I kept coming back, and in a few more weeks, he nominated me secretary, and then, and then he disappeared. And there were many, many weeks that I would show up with a big book and a format, and nobody would be there, you know. But, you know, I hadn't had a cigarette since the early 80s, a day at a time. So anyway, the how it relates to OA is I put on 30 pounds in 30 days. And I went to my AA meetings, and I started bitching about Häagen-Dazs and pizza and the eggnog shakes and taquitos and all of that good stuff. And the same old-timer said, what's the matter with you? Don't you understand? And I did. I finally got it because I knew there was Overeaters Anonymous. Came to you guys, and I sat in the back, and I listened. But I didn't ask for help. And so it took me about a year of gaining more and more weight to finally raise my hand and say, my name is Michael, I'm a compulsive eater, and I need some help. I don't know how to do this. And Matt M., who's still around, I think he moved to another state, reached his hand out. He lost well over 100 pounds, and he knew the big book very, very well, and he gave me his phone number. And he acquainted me with the procedure of taking a fifth step with my food. He asked me what I was going to eat, and I said, I have no idea. And he said, well, why don't you call me and tell me what you've eaten at the end of the day? And it made me conscious of what I was eating. And I didn't really want to know all the crap that I was putting in my body. I didn't know I was anesthetizing my feelings, myself, with food. Sure, I was clean. I was sober. I wasn't smoking cigarettes. But boy, that food sure got me into that wonderful, lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. So anyway... I started calling Matt, and I started working the steps, and the weight came off. And then I took inventories about my past and how when I was in college, I guess I was Issa's age, my first year in college, I was a theater arts major, and I was always a skinny kid, and I always felt uncomfortable in my body, and I guess my metabolism was such that I just couldn't gain any weight, and I thought if I would have a little girth, you know, I'd feel more like a man or whatever. I'd feel better about myself. And so I was a munchkin in my first play, and I had a size 27 waist, and I guess I weighed, 120 pounds or something? I was real thin. And during rehearsals, we'd have breaks, and everybody sort of in the theater arts department seemed to be very gregarious, at least outwardly, and I was just very introverted. And so I found Foster Freeze on the corner of Vermont and Santa Monica. And there were eggnog shakes and there were taquitos with guacamole sauce. And during the breaks, I would go and I would just load up on those things. And it was much more comfortable than socializing with my peers. And at the end of that play, I was a size 36 waist. I weighed 180, 185 pounds. So that's what, a 60, 70 pound weight loss. And I was young, and I thought, well, here's the girth that I need, you know, and I had this pot belly, and I walked around, and I felt, you know, I guess puberty set in when I was 18 years old. And, but I still really didn't feel very comfortable with myself, because then I started, you know, dabbling in drinking and using and stuff, and the cocaine certainly took care of the weight. And so I didn't have to worry about that until I got clean and sober. So I came to you guys and I started doing what you guys do. And around 5 years of abstinence, 5 years of sobriety, I got comfortable and I got complacent. And my history is such that my mom was, when she had me, she had postpartum depression, which I guess a lot of women suffer from when they have kids. But my mom's never got better, and they diagnosed her postpartum psychosis, and then eventually it was schizophrenia. And they couldn't seem to find a cure for her. She had a little bit of wealth, and she spent all of her money on doctors, and she just seemed to get progressively worse and worse. So much so that when she came home, she was like suicidal, and she was a danger to, you know, I was a baby at the time, to herself and to me. So unfortunately, she ended up in Patton State Hospital, which is in San Bernardino. And I remember some weekends my father would take me out to see her, and she'd be very lucid, and she'd cry. She'd say, "Michael, I want to come home and take care of you." And then other weekends, she'd just kind of be catatonic. It was kind of really weird. And she loved shock treatment, because shock treatment, she said, would shock her back into reality, at least temporarily. And I'll tell you, if I was going to choose between schizophrenia and compulsive overeating, I'd take the disease that I have now, because we have a solution for this. And in the early 50s, they had an operation called a lobotomy, and they figured if they cut that part of your brain out that was diseased, that you'd get better. And she was one of the first people that volunteered for that. And she had it, and it didn't make her any better, but it didn't make her any worse. And she ended up in the early 40s, keeling over from a heart attack at Camarillo State Hospital, going to get a pack of cigarettes. And I used to think, when I came to this program, I was pretty ambivalent about God and a higher power, and I used to think, well, what kind of a loving God would take a woman like my mother, who, by the way, was a concert pianist, and had a scholarship to Juilliard. My dad told me all kinds of wonderful stories about her. And also had a stepmother that would stand over her with a wire hanger and beat her if she didn't practice. So anyway, she didn't have a happy life. And I thought, what kind of a higher power would make an individual come to this world and have such a miserable life? And through taking inventory and through kind of getting a new pair of glasses, I realized that if my mom were alive today, she'd be in her 80s. And God forbid that she would be, you know, rambling around, you know, in a mental institution. It might have been a blessing, you know, that God took her so early. And it certainly was a blessing that she gave me life. I'm an only child. They decided not to have children because my mom got sick. And so I've been around you guys for 20-some-odd years, and which is almost a third of my life. And I've been given the gift of abstinence and sobriety and the 12 steps. And I am not wandering around a mental institution. And I have a pretty good life today, a very good life. I'm very blessed. So anyway, I got complacent, and I thought that I might have a chemical imbalance when I didn't want to get up and go to work in the morning, you know. And, you guys told me, well, a lot of us on Monday morning don't want to get up and go to work. You know, just get up and go to work anyway. And I bet I stopped going to you guys because in retrospect, I wanted a fix. I was too afraid of life on life's terms. And so I stopped going to meetings, and I started getting involved in therapy, and I ended up in group therapy. I think in the early 80s, I used to carry teddy bears to meeting and talk to my inner child a lot. And that was really kind of neat. I wasn't married at the time, and women really empathized with me and my teddy bear, especially in OA meetings. It was kind of nice. And I wasn't calling a sponsor, and I got into the ism of the disease, and I got into the resentments, and therapy was telling me to get introverted or feel my feelings, and you guys were telling me, get out of yourself, you know, go help somebody else. That's the only saving grace. I wasn't listening to you guys. I wasn't coming to you guys. And so people got real ugly. I quit a job that I had for 12 and a half years on a part-time basis because I didn't want to commit to a full-time job, because in those days I considered myself an actor, and I had to be available for auditions. So when I left my job at noon, I wouldn't go to auditions, but I went to the beach a lot, and I wanted to work on my tan just in case an audition would come my way. And I had a wife at the time, who is now my ex-wife, I wonder why, who was sort of supporting me in my disease. And so what had happened was I quit this job that I had for 12 and a half years, and I spent all the money that I had in the bank, and the rent was due, and the bills weren't getting paid, and I got real scared. And so I was seeing three psychiatrists at the time. One of them prescribed an antidepressant, which really didn't do much for me. I talk about that in my other program. And I didn't know what to do. And I heard Dr. Paul speak, who is in our big book, who wrote the story on acceptance. If you haven't read that, it's a cool story. And he passed away about 10 years ago. He was just a beautiful man. He would talk to me whenever I called him. And I heard him at this meeting downstairs. And he said something that changed my life, maybe saved my life. He said, never in my 20-some-odd years of program have I had a problem to which the 12 steps did not offer me a solution. And at that time, I was so far away from the 12 steps, and that resonated, that truth resonated so powerfully with me. And so I was afraid to talk to him, but I asked his wife, Max, who was sitting in the front row, for his phone number. And I called him the next day, and I told him what I was up to. And he told me, why don't you come back to the program that was saving your life initially? And I trusted him. And he was a doctor also. He was an MD. And so I started calling him, much like I called Matt in the beginning, because I trusted Matt. And he brought me back to the 12 steps. And I quit all my therapists. And I got rid of my prescriptions to antidepressants. And I put my faith and trust in somebody who was working this program. And I found myself in my sponsors wanted to join a home group in my other fellowship, and I joined a very structured and disciplined home group, and which I got a very structured and disciplined sponsor, and I told the sponsor that I wanted to go to OA because I was eating compulsively. And he said, well, kid, I don't have any experience with that. And I said, well, you know, you believe in one sponsor, and if I go to OA, I'll have to get another sponsor. He says, you go ahead and do that. Go ahead, kid, do what you need to do. And I had his okay, and I got Richie, who had a lot of time in his program and talked like this. And I started calling him on a daily basis, and every time I ate red meat and cheese, he'd say, what are you eating artery clogged for? Artery clogged, don't eat that shit. And he was tough, and he didn't pull any punches, and he also lost over 100 pounds, and he knew all the tricks that I was trying to pull, and he listened to my fifth step. It took 3 days, not three 24-hour days, but, you know, in increments. It took me 3 days to regurgitate all this craziness because he took 3 days to regurgitate with his sponsor. And he is in, I think, North Carolina now. He saved my life one more time. In August last year, my cholesterol went up to 250 points, and that's pretty... I never had a cholesterol problem. And I found myself eating a lot of In-N-Out burgers and protein style, because you throw away the bun, it's healthy, right? So you have it with the lettuce and stuff. But I was eating them like every other day, and I was eating the artery cloggers, and Richie was in North Carolina, and his voice was still in my head, but it was kind of faint. And so my doctor said, you know, you got to do something about your cholesterol. I got a little pill for you. And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of an addict and stuff, and could we, like, forego the pill? And he says, well, it's here if you want it. And I called Richie. He says, why don't you just change your diet a little bit and do some more exercise? And so instead of red meat, started eating chicken and turkey, and I did one more day of exercise, and I started reporting to him what I was eating, and he gave me a real structured food plan. And in about 5 or 6 months, I took my cholesterol reading, and it went from 250 to 150. And so I'm not taking the pill, although, to tell you the truth, I want to take the pill and eat all the red meat I can. But I didn't, and there's like some kind of a higher power that resonates with me, and despite myself, lets me make healthy food choices, you know, despite myself. And it's people like you that get me in touch with that higher power. It's just the Jewish holidays, and, you know, God doesn't resonate in temple with me. He resonates at 5:30, 6 o'clock in Brentwood. It'll light the candle meeting, you know, and that's just the way it is, and I'm grateful for that. I married the lady that could not support me in the manner to which I was accustomed, and I got myself a full-time job, and it's been a fertile abstinence, which means that I have three more children. I had a child from my ex, Sean, who's 33 years old. Sean has 3.5 years clean and sober. I don't know about in your family, but anyway, Sean is clean and sober. And I saw him go through some pretty scary stuff, which reminded me a lot of what my mother had gone through. And it's just a miracle that he decided to latch onto the 12 steps. I have an 18-year-old Isabella who has just started college and is going to Mount St. Mary's, which is a beautiful campus right up on the Bundy Hills over here. It's weird because my wife, after working 33 years consistently at a job, they outsourced her whole department. So she's been unemployed for a couple of years now. And so we've been living on my income and on hers, which is substantially smaller. But we've been able to not only survive but thrive because, you know, Mount St. Mary's is a beautiful private school. And because Christine is unemployed, the scholarship money that Issa was entitled to doubled. So Issa is getting her education almost paid for free. And she's living on campus, and she left home, which was kind of tough. But she's only like a half an hour away. And my other Christine, my wife, is in San Diego with Issa's sister, who's 14, who's the biggest girl of the family. She's almost 60. And she plays basketball, and she's in a tournament. And Nicholas, who is 11, is there to support her. And my mother-in-law went to San Diego as well. So Issa was kind enough. She has tickets to the Wilshire Ebell Theater tonight, and there's some performing artists that are in college. And she has tickets to a concert, and she can take her old man with her and fulfill an obligation of one of her classes. She has to go to a concert tonight. So we ate a late lunch together, and she decided to come to the meeting with me, and then we're going to rush over to the Wilshire Ebell and maybe watch a little Saturday Night Live afterwards. And over her brother's house, her sober brother's house. What else can I tell you? I kind of like to open it up for questions because it gives me a little adrenaline rush, and you never know what you're going to throw at you, and it makes me a little more extemporaneous. So I appreciate you listening, and if anybody has a question, I'd love to answer it. Yeah.
point you got to eating burgers without buns and things. What is your abstinence and how do you decide what you're going to eat?
Well, I haven't had recreational sugar in like 20 years and stuff. And I eat, I used to be concerned about my carbs and everything, but right now I have a very structured food plan, which involves a lot of protein, which isn't red meat, and fruits and vegetables. And it falls within a structure of a certain amount of points every day. And within that structure, the only thing that allows me, and it's so easy for me, Karen, I mean, because I'm used to taking a fifth step, and I call my sponsor every day, and I have a commitment and meeting, and I see other people that are trying to work this structured food plan, and for years and years, you know, and it just works, because I get my spiritual foundation here, and it gives me the power to carry out the structure that I have within my food plan. So I could share more about it with you after the meeting, if you like. Yes, sir.
Thanks for your share.
I'll repeat the question, too.
Yes, sir. Given your family history, it was quite a leap of faith for you to ditch the pills, the antidepressants.
Yeah.
Did the 12 steps work for you? And did it ever happen when you felt a need to go back, or did you ever go back on the pills?
It's interesting because on any given day, if I wake up in fear, yeah, I feel a need to go back on the pills. But the steps, when I hit my knees and I do my ritual of prayers and my sponsees call me and I call my sponsor and I say, well, I can get into the shower. I can shave. I can put on my clothes. I can start the car. I can get Nicholas into the... And I do the next indicated steps. Ironically, those days when I don't want to get out of bed are the best days that I have. And in retrospect, I look back and I go, my God, I didn't want to get out of bed. I had a great day teaching, you know, the other day. And I didn't want to get out of bed. I was tired. So the steps are more than sufficient to fulfill the role of the antidepressants. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not going to talk about that from the podium, but I'll talk to you later about that because I wanted more the minute I took them. So, yes.
Michael, thank you for your lead.
You're welcome. I'll try to remember to repeat the question this time for the microphone.
Would you please help us understand your relationship with your higher power and has it ebbed and flowed over the years?
I don't think it's ebbed and... Oh, the question was my relationship. Thank you, Mickey. I say it in Irish. My relationship with my higher power. Has it ebbed and flowed over the years? It feels like it has, but again, in retrospect, it hasn't. It hasn't because for some reason, I keep showing up and doing the footwork. And I wouldn't do that if I didn't believe there was a power greater than myself that was helping me. I'd stay in bed. I'd be eating pizza tonight, you know. My life, I swear, I almost feel superstitious in saying this. I mean, it... Thank God my kids are healthy. One of my kids is in a beautiful college. My other kid is clean and sober. You know, I've 20 years, you know, in this fellowship, and I'm going to have a birthday next Sunday also in the other fellowship. And, you know, and I know that life's going to change, you know, and I know it's not perfect. But I like I say, on the days that I'm the most scared, it's almost a gift because that's when my higher power is the strongest. And can't explain it and don't need to, but... I believe in it. That's why I'm here tonight. Yes.
Can you describe how your, I guess how the physical recovery came to you? I know there's the emotional piece and the spiritual piece, but how it came, was it over a period of time? Did it seem to kind of all at once and restoration of your body?
It wasn't. It was like a week at a time, a pound at a time, and a day at a time. And it was very, very slow. And it was incremental. And the weight loss would go like this, and then it would go up. But it was steady progressive of down. But there would be times that it would go up like this. And the physical recovery, even today, I run. I try to do cardio maybe four. Richie's voice. 4 to 7 times a week. 4 to 7 times a week. And I do that for delayed gratification because I don't many times like to do it. My head will tell me a million times not to. But I got to tell you, an hour after I'm done with it, I have that. Is it endorphin? Is that the natural drug that you have? That endorphin that just sort of keeps me calm up here. It's that natural chemical. So it's a you know, the health guy knows more than I do, but it's sort of like a natural high, and it's a delayed gratification. And I'll bookend a lot also. If you're having trouble with exercise, I'll call somebody and say, I just don't want to run. I'm going to commit to doing it, and I'll call you afterwards. God help me, and hang up the phone, and I'll call somebody a half an hour afterwards. So it's all kinds of great tools for doing stuff that you don't want to do in this program.
Thank you so much. When you're not willing to do something, like not willing to bookend or text your food or take it, how do you become willing, or how do you work with that?
I just be honest, first of all, with my sponsor. And that's not always easy, and I usually have to tell on myself to a friend. But as soon as I get honest, that humility comes up. Let me think of a specific, oh gosh. You know, the only thing that comes to mind right now is there was an old-timer, his name was Red Sea, and I was not willing to stop this compulsion, the cigarette. How do you become willing when you're not willing, was the question. I'm sorry, Mickey, I'm all over the place. And he would laugh at me, and he'd say, Michael, ask God for the willingness to be willing, the willingness to be willing. And he'd laugh at me. And I ask God for the willingness to be willing to change, and I hit my knees and I ask, and it comes. Just the willingness to be willing. Yeah.
So being in a couple of different programs and, you know, having a couple of sponsors and sponsees and the whole deal, mm-hmm. How do you find balance in all of that stuff, like your meeting schedule and your sponsor schedule and all the things that you have to do to maintain multiple programs?
I take an inventory on a nightly basis. I take a little AEIOU, and I see where I feel overwhelmed at times. And that AEIOU involves what my food intake is and what my resentments are, what my fears are. And usually in the resentments and fears, I give them to my sponsor, and my sponsor kind of helps direct me onto the next indicated event. It's easy. I know Saturday mornings I'm going to be at the kitchen sink because I'm a newcomer greeter there. And I have a Wednesday night commitment at our meeting, and I know where I'm going to be on Friday night. And the commitments keep it real easy. Most of the babies who call me, they have a time. I have a time when I'm going to call my sponsor. It's really easy. You know, when I just look at what's in front of me and have sponsors to help relax me when I get overwhelmed. Thank you for letting me share.